justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
So, my plan for today is to talk about how we got here and basically concluded lessons from the 4+ year of the student revolution and the conflict of Sudan and how that can be there in other countries as well. So my plan is not to talk about the war, but my plan is to talk about the war and then the counter-revolution and how we can over.
So you speak a little louder?
Sure. Is this much better? Okay, cool. So we went from doing weekly demonstrations that were mainly due to increasing prices in main, in food, in fuel, and so on, to basically being having a conversation that maybe we need to choose between two evils, like Shiri mentioned earlier, between the SAF or the RSF. And I want to talk about how that in itself is a policy, and how that in itself is a counter-revolution tactic, having to choose between two pre-designed positions, and how we can build our own position. So, in that intention, I'm going to utilize this timeline. So feel free to go through the timeline as I speak on it. So during December 13 or 15, it doesn't really matter, but December 2018, we see everyone, everyday people, taking to the street, demanding better livelihoods, demanding better prices for fuel, better prices for bread, and so on. It actually started with high school children taking to the street, right? And somehow that developed and evolved, and we took speed to the point that we've seen the rise of SPA, so that is Professional Association, and some sort of a context for that protest. Instead of just asking for a better prices for bread or fuel, you are now asking for a larger change within the entire country. And that is very quickly turned from a centralized entity like the Sudanese Professional Association into a decentralized movement. Neighborhood Resistance Committee did not start in 2018. It's so difficult to actually trace back where it started, maybe in the 2013 uprising. We also had the September 2013 uprising. Maybe that was the start point. But it doesn't really matter as long as we figure out that it's a decentralized resistance movement that is based mainly in geographic areas, like people in different neighborhoods. It's almost like a revolutionary council within the neighborhood, where you take to the street, you organize with your comrades within that particular city or even state in a larger sense, right? So within the second half, or the first half of 2019, Student Property Association and basically every Sudanese person in living can tell that this cannot be sustained and taken further through a centralized resistance movement. It needs to be a decentralized movement, and we've seen it being in formation and development of neighborhood resistance committee and so on. That developed into a sit-in that started in April 6th. In the capital and in other cities around Sudan, I think around 13 other cities around Sudan, in headquarters of the military. And that in itself was another change in the Sudanese revolution. Between January 2019 to April 2019, we have seen the act of resistance to be a daily thing. It's part of your routine. There is, and every Saturday there is a protest, and there is some sort of a communal activity Friday, Saturday, and you spend the entire week in preparation while you're living your day-to-day life in preparation for that. So I think this is one of the biggest lessons, is how you can mobilize the community so that your act of resistance is not separated from your livelihood, it's not separate from your day-to-day. You continue living your life, you go to school, you go to work, you do whatever you need to do, but you have in mind that Saturday, you have in mind that Saturday, right? And you decentralize, so you practice more of your will, you are more free to figure out how you're going to resist this regime that you need to resist, right? So you're not, no one is fighting for you, you're fighting for yourself. And April April 2019 was a change within the Sudanese revolution, in the sense that we kind of created this environment where education is free, healthcare is free, food is free, and you have just this feeling of community where it's almost unreal, but it was very much real, and a lot of us witnessed that. And within that, we've seen also more of a labor organizing. In May 2019, there was a big strike from labor movement, and that actually affected a lot in some analysis. Some people might think that the strengths that labor movement, organized labor movement showed, maybe led in one way or another into the regime thinking that they need to be as brutal as the June massacre, because this is the only way that they thought that they can break this struggle. And we went into a dark 1 month from June 3rd until June 30th. We had no internet, regular cell service was almost non-existing, but still somehow there were strong bond of community that people were able to organize and regroup themselves. And June 3rd was one of the biggest marches. I think it's, what I'm trying to say here is, have like changing from just I need better services for like my day-to-day, I need food, I need access to healthcare, into actually this issue is within the entire country of Sudan, it's not in Sinnar or Damazin, which are like the cities within Sudan, and then try to put a context of that in the Sudanese Professional Association, but quickly realizing that having a centralized entity that lead this struggle or this fight is not going to work, so we tend into being decentralized, and we were able to do that to come strong in June 30th. So this is the main lesson that I think, is mobilizing while having a larger context, and also while engaging each and every one of us at different stages of that mobilization. Within all of that, the counter-revolution never really stopped existing or acting. We have seen the forces of change and freedom, FSC, and we've seen the TMC, and we've seen the change, or like the effort put into selling this idea that we need to solve this through maybe negotiations, and this is how the blood partnership was built end of 2019. I'm not sure how much. So going into 2020, I feel like the resistance, like the revolution somehow lost its footing. There was a lot, it's very, when you're in despair and someone comes and be like, this is it, this is the magical solution, here you go, we need to build this partnership. It's very logical for you to think that, oh, maybe it is a solution, right? And you will take a step back. But very quickly, I think we were able to recover, and we started this new, and by we, I mean like us, the Sudanese people, we started this new idea of like, we're diffusing this blood partnership, and we actually called it blood partnership. We also were faced with another challenge during 2020. I think there was a lot of tendency to separate your struggle, your political struggle, from your day-to-day, to the point that resistance committee were divided in one way or another. Some felt like they need to organize how we access bread, how we access fuel, how we access healthcare, and others felt like we just need to take to the street, weekly protest this partnership, and reclaim back our country. And I am hoping that we are starting to learn that you don't need to separate the two. Your politics should be your access to your house, your access to food, your access to education, and your safety, right? So that, but that divide between should we just try to manage and play the role of the state, or should we fight the state to bring about a better state? That is not a coincidence, or it's a lack of experience, or it's a theoretical weakness. I think that is, and it's not just also linked to Sudan. This is very much how we all have been living under this international capitalistic system, right? We are fed this idea that a state is neutral towards everyone, all classes, and you should just allow the state to do its work, or if you change the state to quote-unquote better state, and I'm putting the quote because I don't think there is a better state, right? I don't think we should trust anyone. Marx himself, bring Lenin right now, and I would not want him to be my president. I thought he was not my president, right? So, anyway, so I think this is not, it wasn't a coincidence, or it wasn't just like a weakness. I think this is very much built into the system, but I'm really hopeful that we are learning that we don't separate the two, and that mutual aid should be very much political. And communities should be very much political, because your everyday livelihood is very much political. So that was what happened in end of 2020, going into 2021. By end of 2021, we've seen another coup, because guess what, that partnership cannot really hold itself, right? There's a lot of contradiction within the partnership itself. And we've seen Neighborhood Research Committee being more political. We've seen them identifying themselves as political entities, having structure, having spokespeople, and starting to write political charters. And within that, we've also seen the difference between the resistance committee in the center in the capital, Khartoum, and in the peripheries. For example, I like to think of Mayerno, which is a small city. They actually signed the political charter and territory. But that political charter is more democratic than anything I have seen. It's truly a bottom-up kind of procedure. And we've seen it with Dufan, which is a larger city, and we've also seen it with Madani. So when we compare that to the political charter that came out of Khartoum, the capital, we see how diluted Khartoum charter was. Mainly because people in Khartoum, their socioeconomic status, kind of want and take them into the direction that we need enough stability to keep the privilege that we have. I think I'll stop here, and hopefully we can continue
this. Hi everyone, thank you so much for being here. I want to thank Shireen and Brian for inviting me to be here, and all the conference organizers for their labor. Making this happen. I'm honored to be on a panel with two women I deeply admire and have learned a lot from. I'm not nearly as knowledgeable or qualified to comment on the lessons and challenges from the Sudanese revolution as they are, but I'm going to try to talk a little bit about three things: the role of external actors and the ways that Gulf actors in particular have played a role both in what's happening and in restructuring Sudan's rural economy, creating the kind of conditions for food insecurity, et cetera, in the agricultural Jazeera region of Central Sudan, which is right south of Khartoum, an area once touted to be the breadbasket of the Middle East, how this restructuring is impacting farmers and more displaced people and their ability to organize and survive during this war, and then at the end offer some thoughts on diaspora organizing and transnational solidarity vis-a-vis Sudan. So if you'll allow me, I'm going to start with some history. Yeah, it's a short historical anecdote. Sudan's December Revolution is often compared to Sudan's 1964 revolution, sparked by clashes between students and police at the University of Khartoum before mushrooming into a broader movement that toppled Abboud's military regime, or to the 1985 revolution triggered by price hikes that toppled Nimeiri's regime. But I want to trace its genealogy actually back to the 1950s. We could go back all the way to the 19th century, but I'm going to start at independence. Britain's parting gift to Sudan at independence in 56 was an economy dependent on the extraction of cash crops like cotton and on the exploitation of farmers and landless workers. And a political system which was constructed to serve the interests of a riverine central Sudanese elite at the expense of the South and other peripheral regions, but also of a rural population that sustained this extractive, export-oriented economy. Some of the initial forms of resistance against the new post-colonial state unsurprisingly came from tenant farmers, who organized to demand, among other things, a greater share of profits as world cotton prices plummeted. A strike took place on a cotton scheme near Kosti shortly after independence. The state responded with extreme violence. Over 300 striking tenant farmers were shot on the fields or suffocated in detention cells. Elders in my family are still haunted by that tragedy. A year earlier, Sudan's first civil war had broken out between South Sudanese demanding political representation and regional autonomy and the central government, who had essentially subsumed the South as a quasi-internal colony. And this 1956 massacre is linked to the civil war because striking farmers were threatening existing capitalist labor relations that allowed ruling elites to extract maximum profits to fund its repressive campaign against southern rebels. And I highlight this moment because it reveals the way state violence in Sudan has long been shaped by the need to reproduce and maintain an extractive war economy that serves elite interests by any means necessary. And we see this play itself out now with various military actors vying not only for political but also economic control of the country. I think it's important for a US audience in particular, which might remember the Save Darfur movement, to understand the genocidal violence in Darfur, which began in the early 2000s, as connected to the brutal civil war in the South, which spanned several decades, and to the current war in Western and Central Sudan. Save Darfur got thousands of Americans to place Darfur on a map often without realizing it was in Sudan, thereby framing the root causes of this violence as disconnected from the rest of the country and a violent, extractive elite state at its center. And to be clear, this is not a failed state, as US and European analysts of political affairs in Africa often claim. Rather, it is a kleptocratic state that is functioning just the way it is intended to extract resources, to accumulate capital and power through violence. So fast forward to the early 2000s, when the Islamist Bashir regime began implementing neoliberal policies to privatize the rural sector and to withdraw state extension services and inputs from small farmers in order to attract foreign investments in land. In a country where 60 to 80% of households rely at least partly on the agricultural sector to make a living. In Central Sudan, where I do my research, which has historically been a stronghold for the regime, most of the deals were signed with Gulf investors. Since the early 2000s, Saudis and Emiratis have invested over $27 billion in Sudanese land, real estate, and infrastructure. Together, they control about 1 million acres of fertile land near the Nile or on top of large underground aquifers, which may seem insignificant, but the larger picture is that these shifts in land ownership have led to smallholder farmers going into debt, being forced to sell land to local elites, and so we see a kind of mushrooming of medium-sized agribusiness farms as many are forced to become seasonal farm workers in larger Gulf or domestic-owned farms. In brief, the agricultural sector has changed significantly since the 2000s upon recommendation of the World Bank, I may add. People are farming, but increasingly no longer on their land, and they're farming less sustainably, less subsistence food. In fact, if you travel south of Khartoum into the rural areas, you'll see many large farms growing primarily water-intensive alfalfa and other kinds of animal feed that is exported to dairy farms in the Middle East. A Saudi farm, reportedly pumped water from an underground aquifer so aggressively that it depleted it in a matter of 3 years. The farm organizers I'm in touch with now tell me that this war has exposed the restructuring of the rural economy. Because people don't have the same capacity for growing and storing subsistence foods, and are more dependent on imported foods and foods brought in from Khartoum than they were a decade ago. Over the last decade, rural stores in Central Sudan are increasingly filled with frozen halal foods and dairy products from the Middle East and local corporate producers as the local dairy industry has gotten decimated. And it's worth noting that the army and the RSF are currently Sudan's biggest employers, which enables them to prey on and recruit nomadic dairy producers whose livelihoods have been undermined in this way because they've lost access to grazing rounds, etc. People are eating more white bread, less nutritious sorghum-based foods like kisra, asida, due to these shifts. Right? People in rural areas south of Khartoum are dealing at the moment with massive price hikes, food shortages, regular disruptions to supply chains, while also hosting one of the largest groups of internally displaced people from this war, from Khartoum. The planting season began in June, but most farmers didn't have the means to purchase the seeds, fertilizers, and pesticides they needed to farm. There have been major electricity disruptions that prevent them from pumping water onto the farms. Calls by an independent farmers union for international aid to be diverted to farmers so they could plant were largely ignored in favor of subsidized USAID wheat and other kinds of food aid being dumped in small but significant amounts in local markets. And people are surviving through collective organizing and volunteering, leading relief efforts, communal kitchens, emergency medical care and response rooms, converting schools and other public spaces into shelters, distributing food and other resources. But there are limits to how much people can do when there are no salaries and food shortages and the planting season fails. It's important to mention that most of the labor, almost 70% that is performed on farms in the Jazeera, is done by farm workers, many of whom are women. And one member of an association of farm workers called the Kanabi Association that I spoke with said that the situation for wage laborers is particularly challenging because there's much less work, they have less of a safety net than the small farmers they work with, etc. And one of the challenges before and during the transition has been a kind of disalignment between the independent farmer organizers, and the Farm Workers Association that, in my view, has a more radical political agenda around land justice that will be critical in the future, particularly in light of the role of Gulf actors. Last June, the Emiratis signed a $6 billion deal with the Sudanese elite to build a massive port project along the Red Sea that would link to a large agricultural project through a private toll road and include an airport. The deal never materialized, but its signing signaled the willingness of Sudanese elites to collude with Emirati elites to undermine Sudan's national port and to expand their agricultural investments, thereby deepening their influence over the ways food is produced, distributed, and circulated. The Emirates is now one of the most harmful actors in this war through their involvement in Sudan's illicit gold trade, which is one of the ways the RSF has amassed their wealth, and there are some reports that they're shipping in weapons through General Haftar in Libya. The Emirates and Saudi Arabia used both SAF and RSF troops to fight on their behalf in the war in Yemen, expanding their transnational connections and networks. The Emiratis and Saudis are, of course, not the only actors. Turkey is also increasing its kind of engagement with military elites, and there are many others. But I think these are the two of the most significant actors whose involvement in hosting or mediating peace talks needs to be understood within this context of their desire to protect their economic and geopolitical interests in the region. Even the U.S.'s role in Sudan is sometimes mediated through these actors. As you know, Sudan's been under European and U.S. sanctions since the Clinton era, but one of the things we saw towards the latter part of the Bashir regime, and certainly during the transition, was a kind of gradual thawing or normalization between the Bashir and the U.S. regime under Obama and Trump. In the years leading up to the revolution, we saw the EU fund the al-Bashir regime to the tune of $200 million to use the RSF as militarized border control at their externalized border between Sudan and Libya to stem the migration of Africans into Europe. We saw IMF-recommended austerity measures being implemented, which caused some of the price hikes that partially triggered the revolution. Under Hamdok, certain U.S. sanctions that had been in place since the 90s were removed in return for a normalization of Sudan's relationship with Israel, mediated in part by the Emirates, and a removal of Sudan from the travel ban list. And I want to just basically say the U.S. is not as big of an actor in Sudan as it imagines itself to be. But U.S. government officials and investors have been engaging with military elites for several years now under Obama and al-Bashir during the transition, including organizing high-level meetings with military elites in Sudan during key moments of the transition to express interest in land, infrastructure, and mineral exploitation, for instance, as protesters were being brutalized on the streets, right? U.S. officials have been meeting, and they've met with a few members of resistance committees as a way of claiming they've engaged with these actors and legitimizing the harmful role that they've played in entrenching elite politics and militarized stability over radical change. So what might transnational solidarity look like in this context? During the transition period, particularly before the October 2021 coup, we saw an unprecedented number of organized acts of civil disobedience across Sudan, from some of the longest worker strikes in Sudan's history, to protests against the use of toxins and gold mining in South Kordofan, to powerful teacher strikes in Darfur. This organizing was driven primarily by resistance committees and other grassroots formations and working class unions. The revolution evolved during this period in part because its most radical elements had been purposefully cut out of the transitional government. And one of the things I've learned from doing diaspora organizing since the 2000s, early 2000s, is that we've often played a de-radicalizing role that undermines the political power and potential of radical or revolutionary organizers on the ground. Diaspora folks have often taken up too much space and played too large of a role by, for example, occupying key positions on the elite civilian side of the transitional government and steering the country economically and politically onto the same neoliberal path that triggered the revolution. We've also played a de-radicalizing role by allying with groups like Save Darfur and the National Endowment for Democracy, whose primary purpose is to de-radicalize, NGOize, or co-opt the work of radical grassroots groups fighting for democracy in Africa, even if they are not always successful at this aim. Many of us have worked for international NGOs whose liberal, bureaucratic, tax, registration, and reporting requirements have a similar aim of de-radicalizing, NGOizing, and co-opting the work of groups on the ground, often subsidizing the salaries and lifestyles of foreign NGO workers in the process. Many of us have put too much faith in the capitalist state as an apparatus to do the right thing, believing that somehow these states, whether it is the US government and other states or the Sudanese regime, will somehow serve the interests of the masses if we just pressure them hard and long enough. Rather than exposing the harmful role the US and other states have played through their investments and political engagements, we have often called for more intervention, in some instances even military intervention, rather than pushing for a hands-off approach as comrades from Haiti have. The strategy has often been to ask why the US is not paying enough attention to Sudan and the region, rather than challenging the many ways that they are. And that includes their violent border regimes and migration policies, the presence of AFRICOM, the extractive shell companies, their militarized war on terror, etc., etc. So for me, one of the lessons learned from the revolution is that the diaspora needs to take a step back, even in the way we are engaging with people on the ground during this war. Yes, we need to support people on the ground that have been filling the role of an absent state since before the war, but what that support looks like needs to be driven by people on the ground. And there's much work to do vis-a-vis our own governments and corporations. And I realize there are risks, especially for those who live and work in the Gulf, but this is where coalition building and collaboration comes in. Here in the US, there are opportunities to work with groups like the Black Alliance for Just Immigration and other Black-led migrant justice groups who are organizing beyond demands to extend temporary protected status for Sudanese refugees around past citizenship for Sudanese and other Black migrants. Before the 2021 coup, the farmers' union I spoke about was starting to link with other land rights and landless movements through the Via Campesina, but there were challenges around language and visas. But these are, to me, the most helpful avenues for transnational people-to-people solidarity. And there is a role we could play in facilitating these connections. I'm going to stop here in the interest of time. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much. That was extremely helpful, both of you. So Muzan, as I said, she's in Port Sudan, and she said she would prefer it if I, because of the connection difficulties, she sent me her comments, and I'll read them. So she says, "Hello, everyone, and thank you for the platform. I'll try to give a quick overview of the situation in Sudan in terms of organizing and some of the major revolutionary organizing lessons, and then look at the opposite side of revolutionary grassroots organizing, that being the efforts of international institutions and anti-democratic governments and their counter-revolutionary ways and failures, and maybe find some lessons there as well. Now, as you know, there's a war going on in Sudan. The current war broke out in the capital on April 15th, around 5 months ago, and it came about a year and a half after a military coup that ended the transitional period, which started in 2019, following a popular uprising which ended the previous dictatorship. It is clear from this sentence alone that a lot of political changes took place in Sudan in the past 4 years, and some of its major events are listed in the handout you're provided. I'll go over some of the events of these years, focusing on the evolution of organized resistance. So the December Revolution in 2018 started with scattered demonstrations and a newly announced organization named the Sudanese Professionals Association, the SPA, which took lead of the protests and started issuing schedules and assembly points for weekly protests, and people showed in numbers larger than we saw on the streets for decades. These demonstrations were faced with a lot of violence from the state, and therefore the SPA called for the formation of neighborhood resistance committees, basically to organize several protests at the same time and minimize the ability of the state to suppress all of them. This was the beginning of a new phase of grassroots organizing in Sudan that brought in groups and individuals previously excluded from the political arena controlled by the elites and maybe some student politics. However, the SPA only expected them to be foot soldiers to enable or establish protest actions and did not provide a channel for the resistance committees to participate in decision making. After the June 3rd massacre, where state forces attacked 14 peaceful sit-ins around Sudan, killed hundreds and wounded thousands, the massacre was followed by a countrywide internet shutdown, as Rabat discussed. And as the main tool of communication for the SPA was their Facebook page, the SPA was no longer able to address the Sudanese people or the revolutionary committees without internet. The revolutionary committees were forced by this reality to network on the ground among each other and formed coordination bodies of revolutionary committees in neighborhood bodies and called for a million-person march against military rule and made it happen in less than a month after the massacre and all the brutality that followed. That was the June 30th protest. The seed of organized grassroots resistance grew larger than the organization that initially called for it. The revolutionary neighborhood committees became larger than the SPA, the Sudanese Professionals Association, and even parted ways with them. As the SPA and the alliance had formed of the classical elitist parties, as they negotiated and partnered with the military criminals, the revolutionary neighborhood committees took a very different position, committed to the definition of military rule as a counter-revolutionary one and demanding justice for the martyrs of the massacre killed by the forces of the military council. The resistance committees are mostly formed of groups who have no interest in who becomes minister, but are committed to a better life for them and their families and neighborhoods and communities. This led the resistance committees to take a strong stance against the military council. It also led them later during the transitional period to reject austerity measures introduced by partnership government and supported by international monetary institutions. And it was during this time of austerity where the traditional government attempted to depoliticize, as Rabab explained, the resistance committees and turn them into service provision arms of the state and had different levels of success and failure with that attempt. The transitional period was a series of challenges for the resistance committees. They were always between the questions of the interest of the people and the propaganda of the transitional government, which proclaimed itself a representative of the revolution, and therefore any objections to its decision was against the revolution itself, and those who expressed it were considered, they considered them enemies, or they proclaimed them enemies of the revolution. The horizontal nature of the resistance committee's coordination and the lack of a central leadership made it difficult for the counter-revolutionary parties to find a center to co-opt and corrupt. This helped the RCs a lot. I'll just call them the RCs from now on. However, that lack of a central leadership coupled with the lack of an ideological reference that the RCs agree on meant they moved very slowly and wasted a lot of energy. The transitional period was ended by a coup by the military council against their civilian partners. That's the coup of October 2021. This coup was resisted by the RCs, who by then had become the most popular political player, as other civilian political actors lost popular support due to their counter-revolutionary positions during the transitional period. The RCs were the organizations most trusted by the public, and they led peaceful protests against the coup for over a year. The organizing efforts of the RCs saved Sudan from military rule one more time. And during this time, the RCs also evolved in terms of their political project, which became more defined by the lessons learned from the failures of the transitional period. And that is one of the best things organizing gives us, the tools to accumulate lessons and progress towards our political goals. The political project of the RCs were expressed in political charters issued during the year after the coup, where the RCs articulated programs of economic and social justice and tools of electing governments from the bottom up to take over the state by the power and the support of the people. It is no surprise that on the other side, the elitist parties were negotiating with the same military that toppled their government to return to the seats of government in a new, old, repeated setup. The war violently interrupted the situation on April 15th, about 5 months ago. Lost my place. The seeds of organizing again grew according to the needs of the people after the war. The RCs and other grassroots organizations formed emergency rooms that operated healthcare facilities and community kitchens in war-torn areas, and organized evacuations and prepared evacuation centers. This shows that not only are people capable of collectively managing their resources and services, but that this is definitely a better way to provide services for the people. This idea of self-organizing and self-management of resources and democracy from below is one that was ridiculed by the Sudanese elite and the international community when presented in the RC's charters. The UN Secretary General said the people of Sudan should be realistic and accept a deal with the military. But here we are, different factions of the military are killing us. The people of Sudan found no help but from their own organized grassroots, while UN agencies failed to even evacuate the people properly, their people properly. And let's talk here about the UN, the international negotiators, the EU, the embassies of the US and the UK and UAE and Saudi and Egypt. All those and other regional and international anti-democratic governments and institutions have intervened in Sudanese politics and counter-revolutionary wars, ways in the past years. They supported the first partnership with the military despite popular rejection and despite the crimes of the military council, and promised that it would be the path to stability, but it clearly ended with a coup. And they went back and supported more negotiations with the military council, including both the RSF and the SAF at the time. Because they said, again, that's the Sudanese Armed Forces, and they're outlined on the table, and the Rapid Support Forces. Because they said that's more realistic than peaceful resistance to military rule, and more realistic than a people's government. And that ended with a war between the RSF and the SAF, and now people are being saved by self-governance. So I can sit here and tell you dozens of examples on how the ways of these diplomats and agencies and institutions have led to the death and suffering of millions, and you probably know many more, and we all know that. One, they have interests very different from those of the majority of the people, and two, that they are so incompetent on top of them being evil, and that led to many wars and dictatorships in power because of that. This is where I think holding governments and international institutions accountable for their impact around the world is an important task, and the first task of solidarity we need from the people of these countries. I'd like to close with this one incident where I think the RCs showed simple and efficient revolutionary creativity. This was in the first few months after the coup. The UN agencies were trying to get the RCs to join the negotiations with the civilian elite and military coup leaders. The RCs rejected were called immature and incapable of political action. And after much debate, they agreed and came to meet the UN special representative and had one condition, that the entire meeting would be streamed live on Facebook for the Sudanese people to watch. The UN special rep refused, citing security concerns. And for months afterwards, his office continued to invite RCs for meetings, never addressing that one request. The RCs here clearly leaned on their actual power, the public, and called the elite's forces to come out of their comfort zones of closed room deals, hidden from the public because they are against the interest of the public. Grassroots organizing in Sudan provided efficient solutions that protected people and advanced the revolution. However, the lack of political organization with a clear revolutionary ideology and project limits the ability of these organizations to direct their efforts towards building a new system instead of pressuring the old system for demands. That is apparent in the emergency rooms we mentioned earlier. These great efforts of service provision can be the seed for self-governance systems that radically oppose the war and any violent and unjust political project by organizing a more just one. But the lack of the political project is keeping them limited to emergency firefighting efforts that will soon exhaust the resources of those working on them. The lack of a clear revolutionary ideology also left the resistance susceptible to the propaganda of the transitional government and now of the army, for example. There are many lessons on organizing in the Sudanese revolution, and I hope I managed to give you some introduction to start your discussion on. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.